begin this morning in this new series with an exam. Uh-oh. Are you ready for this? This is a multiple choice, not no essays. Two questions. Choose A or B. The greatest need in my life is more faith. That's A. The big need in my life is more self-discipline. That's B. Now, I know you'd like to check both of those, but which is the greatest? Number two, second question, or second choice. My biggest challenge is to make time to meditate, listen, and appreciate God and others. Or B, laziness is my biggest problem. I need to be more productive and efficient.
Can I answer these for somebody else?
Yes, you can. Well, if you're like many people, and I can identify, especially earlier in my Christian life, with this more than now, my prayers were for more discipline and to be more fruitful and efficient. As I got older, that has changed. I recognize that my real need is more faith and more time for spiritual leisure. And that leads us to the series that is going to occupy the next several sessions on Jesus' teaching with respect to his relationship with Mary and Martha in an encounter. This is a t-shirt that I thought was interesting. Jesus coming, look busy. And it falls on the heels of our study of Daniel, where we noted that in the book of Daniel, there are no exhortations in terms of things that we are to do. There are a lot of implications in terms of the importance we have as disciples of God, Christ, to watch and wait, but not to work. Now, that is not to be misunderstood as work is not important, work is important. But I think we tend to overemphasize it. Picasso was right. It is your work in life that is the ultimate seduction. Because for many people, it's in our work that we find our sense of significance and meaning. One of the first questions we often ask someone when we meet them is, what do you do? And what we mean by that is not what do you do in your leisure time or what kind of person you are. It's what's your professional career? That is the way in which we identify ourselves and others. And as I've said before, in our culture, we tend to worship at work, work at play, and play at worship, in terms of the evangelical culture especially. A.W. Tozer has lots of quotable quotes. This is my favorite. We take a new convert and immediately make a worker out of him. God meant that a convert should learn to be a worshiper, and after that, he can learn to be a worker. And in evangelical Christianity, that is certainly a problem. We want to keep people busy. We want to fill up the calendar with meetings. We want sermons that exhort us and instruct us and manage us in doing things. And again, don't misunderstand me. Doing is important, but in a context. Jesus' teaching. Which is the great commandment, the law? And Jesus said to them, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. This is the great and foremost commandment. The second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. Two observations. The two are inseparable. They are one commandment. But the order is significant. It's our love for God that's the foundation for our love for one another. And it's very easy for us, in the context of the Christian church and Christian culture, to basically assume the love of God and just emphasize the love for one another. As a matter of fact, in some Christian circles, broadly speaking, the whole emphasis of theology is how we relate to one another. As a matter of fact, some people would say, some students of religion in America would say, the essence of religion, period, is how we relate to one another. It has very little to do with which God you believe in or which God you worship or whether you worship God at all. We're concerned only how do you love and care for the planet and for those who live on it. When you read the scripture, you get a very, very different picture than that emphasis. In Daniel, as I said, if we look at people's response to the revelation that God has given us and to the world in which we live, or the things we have to live with, we can worry, whine, and work, or in the case of Daniel's posturing of biblical character or godly character, we can wait and watch. And with respect to prophetic things, what's going to happen in history, a lot of what we learned from Daniel is the importance of waiting and watching. We're not going to change which has been decreed. We can change the details. But if we think somehow, for example, we're going to, by our effort, bring about a utopia, heaven on earth, and you take Daniel seriously, the prophecies there, you recognize God has decreed it's not going to happen that way. It's going to get worse before it gets better. And it'll get better when Christ comes, not when we basically get our way or our plans become operative. That's hard for us to accept because part of our culture in America is that just get it done. We can do it. If you can dream it, you can do it. In Mary and Martha's story, we can substitute worry and waiting for worship. Because here we have a contrast between two sisters. One is working and the other is worshiping at Jesus' feet. And Jesus makes a big point of this. And we'll read the story. It appears in Luke chapter 38 and goes through verse 42. And what I want to do is just this morning make some observations. This is going to be the first lesson in a series on this parable because there's a lot that needs to be said about the relationship of worship and work. Now, as they were traveling along, he, that is Jesus, entered a certain village, and a woman named Martha welcomed him into her home. Now, that would suggest that Martha was a stranger. Martha wasn't. Martha and Mary were close to Jesus. He loved both of them dearly. And she had a sister called Mary, who more was listening to the Lord's word, seated at his feet. But Martha was distracted, or literally drawn away, with all her preparations, and she came to him and said, "Lord, do you not care that my sister has left me to do all the serving alone? Then tell her to help me." But the Lord answered and said to her, "Martha, Martha, you are worried and bothered about so many things, but only a few things are necessary, really only one. For Mary has chosen the good part, which shall not be taken away from her." Now there are some cultural details and context that need to be highlighted here. The first is this. Hospitality in the ancient Near East was mandated and a virtue. We look at hospitality as an option here. When someone is hospitable, we comment on that. Ah, how nice. They were so gracious. When someone is not, we say, well, they're busy. You know, they didn't have time, or so forth and so on. In the ancient Near East, and even in the modern Near East, hospitality plays a very, very central role in terms of social interactions. You did not have the option of not being hospitable. It was intentionally rude to not give what you had, even to your enemy, when they came and needed help. Jesus deeply loved Mary and Martha. We know this from other texts of Scripture that tell us about the relationship. And it was not just Mary he loved Martha. As a matter of fact, the text suggests that he probably preferred Martha over Mary in some respects. was considered improper for, and even disrespectful for, a woman to be taught the law. So Mary's posture at the foot of Rabbi Jesus was something that was not only unusual, it was seen as disrespectful. It was something that a woman shouldn't do. A man, yes, but not a woman. Now, these are things that when we understand them and go back to the story, make the story come alive in certain areas. General observations we can make. First of all, Mary expected Jesus to support her criticism of... Martha expected Jesus to support her criticism of Mary. The text suggests, by the way in which it's constructed, that Martha fully recognized that she had a right to get Mary to work in the kitchen. And she expected Jesus certainly understood that. And she had no doubt in confronting Jesus and saying, listen, have you missed this? Have you overlooked this? Here is a woman sitting at your feet when she should be in the kitchen helping me be hospitable and provide an environment for you. Jesus' response is shocking. Now, this isn't the only place where Jesus shocked people. I mean, as a matter of fact, a parable we're going to look at in this series down the road, the parable of the prodigal son, is one, again, where he's shocked. You have one delinquent son and one very obedient son. And the point of the parable is that the father welcomes the disobedient son, and he excludes, or he allows the older son to self-exclude himself from the banquet at the end of the story. Jesus does just the opposite of what culture and tradition would have expected in that situation. The same is true here. Jesus comments in response to Martha certainly were shocking. Martha is critiquing Mary, not vice versa. This is significant. Martha is the one who's upset about the dissonance between Mary and Martha. Mary is not worried about this. There's no indication in this text that Mary is concerned about what Martha is doing. Martha is critiqued not for her workplace, but for the focus and her priorities. It's her distraction. It's her preoccupation. Jesus is not saying, listen, the kitchen has ended. Shut the kitchen down. No more kitchen. He's not saying that. He's saying, Martha, you are distracted by lots of things. And it's almost as though you could read into that, Martha, I look into your life and it's not just the kitchen. It's everything else that comes along distracts you. Now, I mean, I'm reading that into it, but the idea is, so many things, he says, Martha, distract you.
So it's not just this particular event necessarily.
It could have been a description of her soul. Mary is drawn to Jesus. Martha is drawn away by other things. That's the bottom line. Now, these words, worries and trouble, that Jesus used to describe Martha's spirit, appear elsewhere in the writing of Luke. In Luke chapter 8 and verse 14, the parable of the soil and the sower. The seeds which fell among the thorns, these are the ones who have heard, and as they go on their way, they are choked with worries and riches and pleasures of this life and bring no fruit to maturity. That's the soil, basically, that had the thorns growing, the competition, this distracted attention away from the seed. And in Acts chapter 20 and verse 10, you remember in one of Paul's sermons, someone fell asleep and fell to their supposed death. There was a certain man named Eutychus, and fell when he fell asleep after Paul's preaching. I don't know how eloquent Paul was, but apparently that night wasn't really with it. He's picked up dead. But Paul went down and fell upon him, and after embracing him, he said, do not be troubled, for his life is in him. This is the same word that is used in the story of Mary and Martha. Mary was troubled, anxious, concerned. What am I do now? How are we going to work this thing out? This is falling apart. If I don't worry, who is going to worry? And if we don't get this meal prepared and this setting right, I mean, we're going to be culpable. Our friends are going to talk about us in ways that aren't very pleasant. Here's the point, or the points, that I want us to appreciate from this. What we learn from Mary. We'll look at Martha later. Leisure is needed for life. Now, I'm going to spend some time talking about that a little bit. Mary models a healthy church. Mary can be a Pharisee. In other words, you can be in Mary's position and have a Martha spirit. And I find my true self in worship. And Sabbath is a lifestyle. So we'll start with number one. Leisure is needed for life. Time out. Spiritual time out. Traditional culture values leisure. Values leisure as time to reflect, to refocus, and renew. Traditional culture. We are not a part of traditional culture. We live in a modern culture. Leisure is the L word. It's basically translated lazy. Unproductive. A book that I've recommended several times, and by the way, I've loaned the book to someone in this class probably, and I can't find it, so if you've got it, give it back to me. The Geography of Good and Evil. The book I thought was very insightful. European philosopher makes the statement. Modern Western culture has lost an appreciation, the importance of leisure, that is time to reflect and imagine. By leisure, I don't mean sleeping late and watching television. By leisure, I mean spiritual leisure, time to reflect and to dream. I grew up on a farm. Some of you know that. And on a farm, you do a lot of work. We did not have technology. We did not have running water or electricity when I was a young boy. We worked for everything. It was not an easy life in many respects. But what people don't realize is that when you work in a farm or live in a farming community, you work seasonally. There are times when you don't have much work at all, and there's no place to go. So what do? You look at the clouds. You watch the corn grow. You go fishing. And you think. And you think. And you reflect. And you regurgitate. And you dream. That's the kind of leisure we're talking about. I can remember many hours as a young boy laying on my back on the lawn of our house, overlooking a field, and just watching the clouds, and looking at the clouds making shapes that reminded me of things, and the shapes would change, and the colors would change. Have you done that? Some of you have. Some of you have.
Rorschach test.
There's the workaholic right there. But the point is, that time, I don't find in my schedule now much anymore. I mean, I have lots of time for reflection, but it's not like that, because my time is filled up, my schedule's filled up, and I live in an environment where I don't have opportunities to not have a clock with me. Time out in traditional culture was something that was just there. And our technology, you'd think, would give us more time for that. It's given us less because our expectations are much higher in terms of being productive. Listening. It takes quiet time to listen to our own souls as well as the Spirit of God in us. Spiritual formation starts with knowing yourself. And many of us have not spent nearly enough time thinking about why do we do things? What motivates us? What's really behind my anger? What's really behind my fear? So forth and so on. And rehashing, regurgitating past experiences, not in terms of trying to defend ourselves, but just trying to learn from things that have happened to us. Hearing God speak to us through other people and through circumstances. Looking for God's hand in life and taking time to have an aha moment. Solitude was an important part of Jesus' life. And in many respects, Jesus' life was a model of private meditation. You'd think that if God sent his son to a needy planet and his son was equipped with all of the tools he had, all of the wisdom he had, and he was given only 3 short years to minister. I mean, God's inefficiency is just absolutely astonishing. And why he would call that the fullness of the time when there wasn't an internet. You know, just think what Jesus could have done with the internet. How busy he could have been. And even in the primitive cultural situation in which he lived, when you read the stories of Jesus, you can't help but notice the times that he gets away. It's not just always with people. It's not just always having a production schedule or planning a strategy for reaching the world. There was a plan, but it wasn't strategized the way in which we would. And fellowship. We can expect God to speak to us through the experiences of life and other people. I benefit a great deal from time alone talking with friends. And it's not just the comfort of it, it's what I learn. Bert and I walk every week. I am stimulated so much by our conversations. I walk with Pete Uhlenberg every week. Same thing. I see Dr. Bill Wilson every week. Same thing. There are 4 or 5 other people that I have regular contact with. I just enjoy getting together with them because of what I'm going to hear. And it's not just what they say, it's the conversation triggers things in my mind. Aha, the aha moments. Now I understand something I didn't before. Now I see something about myself I didn't before. Now I understand this relationship that I had, this encounter I had, in a way in which I didn't before. And without the catalyst of fellowship, that doesn't take place. The same is true even in a class like this. The feedback that comes in. One of the things that I really regret in this class is there's not a forum where we can really talk to one another. Because when that happens, I learn a lot. And it's, I'm not just learning to basically have notes to take, notes to give. I'm learning, because I'm always listening in terms of how can I understand how this impacts me? How can I understand how the things that I have to live with and live for can be configured in such a way that the things I'm living for outweigh the things I'm living with? And then that's really the essence of life. The essence of disciple, being a disciple of Jesus Christ, always having the things you live for trumping the things you have to live with. This is the secret to understanding Daniel. He had to live with a lot of stuff, but what he was living for made the big difference. Learning. We should frequently have aha moments and experiences in life. And very frankly, I don't know if this is true with you, but with me, learning energizes me. What got me started in my Christian life was learning. When someone was able to teach me that the Bible was not just these old stories that went nowhere and never touched life, when someone showed me how the stories, the teaching of the Scripture touched my life, and I came away with an aha moment, I was motivated not only to learn more, but to do something with this. To try it out. To exercise faith. And you may not share the same temperament that I have, but my expectation as a teacher is this. When you learn something, it's going to have a difference in your life. You're going to be energized to want to be more engaged in your faith. You're going to want to try it out. You say, that's strange, I've never heard that before. I'm going to think about that. Or, I'm going to trust God for this and see if it works. And if it doesn't work, why it doesn't work? What do I have to learn next? Learning creates a hunger. And that hunger motivates us in our life. A few suggestions if you're stuck and don't know how to find spiritual leisure. One, go fishing. It's more about wading than catching fish. Or a friend of mine who's a serious fisherman says, killing fish. You go out to kill fish. Don't just catch it. But I find that the richest experience in fishing oftentimes is just sitting there and waiting. And reflecting. And feeling the breeze. Looking at the clouds. Thinking. For some of us, we just need to do that once in a while and not feel guilty about it. Give time to the arts. I don't know about you, but for me, music is the language of the soul. And a good concert is a place where I do a lot of thinking. I sit in a concert with nothing else to do but allow the music to affect my mood of my heart, and to reflect. That's what I'm talking about in terms of leisure and meditation. And I don't see this as carnal or fleshly or worldly. I see this as basically the avenues to which God speaks to us. It's those times when He opens the doors of the parts of our life that basically are kept shut by the technology and the production-oriented, do it, just get it done mentality. Having a regular quiet time. Now, if you're in an evangelical tradition, your upbringing, you've been taught part of the discipline of the Christian life is every day set aside some time to be with God, read the Scripture, pray. Now, for many people, unfortunately, that becomes simply a legalistic ritual. I read a chapter a day, and I have a prayer list. And I got a lot to do today, so I got to get through this real quick. Too much for judges. Now, the prayer list. Aunt Sarah, Billy, now get to work. What I'm saying is, that's not leisure or meditation. That accomplishes nothing. I'm sure God is really impressed with those prayers and should take action immediately. The kind of prayer that is a part of leisure is not petition with respect to work. It's basically reflection. Is asking questions that have to do with my character, with who I am, not what I do so much. Now, there's a place for praying, petitions for work, but that's not the thing I'm talking about with respect to what Mary is teaching us in the story. It is really easy for us to have a disciplined quiet time and never have a quiet time. We just basically have a brief timeout that's not really a timeout. We're just taking a deep breath and waiting to work. Leisure is needed for life because the Sabbath was instituted for that purpose. Observe a Sabbath day. Paul is very clear, the Sabbath is not something we legalistically do, but there's a reason the Sabbath was given as a part of the law. It was for man's benefit. We need to stop in our tracks with respect to our activity and sometimes be disciplined just to say, one day you don't do anything but reflect. You worship. You listen. You meditate. You don't just prepare for more work. Second, Mary models a healthy church. And this is what I mean by that. Corporate worship that draws our hearts to the glory of God and the truth about who God is and who we are is what should happen in a church. There are a lot of churches where this seldom happens. And I'm going to make a brash statement here. My suggestion is this. When you go to a corporate meeting of worship and don't come away with a sense of awe concerning what God, who God is, and what He has done in Christ. And how that reflects upon you, sometimes in some pretty convicting ways. If that doesn't happen, I would suggest something is very, very lacking in that worship experience, or it may not be a worship experience at all. It is that kind of experience where I find myself in awe of God that is significant. I need that on a regular basis. I need to have my battery recharged frequently, because there are many distractions in life that basically challenge that. And the one thing that should happen is not just have we learned something new? Well, we should learn things too. But basically, do we see something again that we've forgotten? Do we see God and see ourselves in a way in which we haven't before? A sensitive calendar. One of the things that I really appreciated about the people who were involved in founding the Chapel Bible Church is from the very beginning, they were saying, we're not going to load the calendar with all kinds of meetings. We want people to spend time with their families and time away from busyness. And that is something that I think was very, very wise. Lots of calendars, and church calendars are filled up every night of the week. We're proud of that. We've got something going every night of the week. And for the spiritual people, they're there on Sunday morning, Sunday school, Wednesday night, Friday night, and Monday prayer meeting, and so forth and so on. Glory be to God. We got everybody busy. And I'd suggest there's nothing necessarily wrong with that, but the spirit of that sometimes is busyness is what God is looking for. As opposed to, are people really listening? Are people really reflecting? Are they seeing anything other than just being busy? There's no virtue in being busy. Modeling by leaders of a life of peace through reflection, meditation, worship, and loving relationships. As opposed to busyness, we need leaders in our churches who basically will show people how to relax spiritually, how to experience profitable leisure time, not to worry, not to be anxious, to walk by faith, and business meetings. When I was working as a church consultant with a large Presbyterian church in Newark, New Jersey, over the course of 2 years, I went to every business meeting they had. And part of my purpose in doing that is you learn a lot about a church by going to a business meeting. You learn a lot about a church and what's really going on. When you start talking about people's money, and I'm saying it's not God's money now, it's people's money. That's the way it's handled. You find out if it's God's money or people's money in terms of how decisions are made or when changes are taking place. Business meeting, well, you'll find out if people love one another, if they listen to one another, if they manipulate one another, if they control one another. All that comes out in the business meeting. They may look like a wonderful, loving fellowship during the week, but at the business meeting, you'll find out. That's when the exam is taken. Secondly, Mary can be a Pharisee. Spiritual pride that stands in judgment of those who are not in the, or in the kitchen doing God's work is not the kind of thing we see in Mary. Mary is not judging Martha. Preoccupation with Jesus leaves little room for judging others. A person who is basically the judge, a person who has the gift of discerning other people's sins, that is a person, generally speaking, who is not preoccupied with Jesus. Now, I'm not saying that discernment is unimportant. It is very important. But for many of us, it is a vocation. And the discernment is in terms of judgment. And I can't help but wonder, what is the focus of our attention? Is the focus on our Lord, or is it on one another and ourselves? There are certain temperaments, by virtue of their strength in other areas, are just geared to blaming or shaming. If something goes wrong, someone is at fault. Either I have failed or you have failed. But someone failed. And we're going to find out who it is and make sure they know about it. And those people not only punish others, they punish themselves. At that point, in that particular temperament scenario, particularly, there needs to be a time of time out to say, hold it. if I'm focusing my attention on Jesus, as Mary was, I'm not going to be worried about Martha. There's a time when someone has to deal with Martha. Jesus will do it. We'll do that. But when my attention is focused in the right place, I'm not going to be preoccupied with that. The inner life is the issue, not the outer life. Again, you can have a daily quiet time and have to be disciplined to do it every day, 7 days a week. I'm not impressed with that, necessarily. I want to find out, was contact ever made in those times with yourself or with God? Did anything ever happen there? Was there ever an aha moment? Was there ever a sense in which you really weren't watching your clock? When you weren't preparing or thinking about work? Legislated leisure that manipulates behavior through guilt and shame is a Martha thing. And I've seen this happen in churches. We're going to have a spiritual life week retreat. And we're going to get together and we're going to basically cleanse our ways from our workaholic behavior and our busyness, and we're going to meditate on Jesus. Now, as a result of this time together, we're going to set aside Monday night for meditation. Everyone's expected to clear their calendar and be home with their families, reflecting on the things of the kingdom of God. And we're going to start basically observing the Sabbath. Now, we're not going to be legalistic about it, but we're expecting the spiritual people to be quiet on the Sabbath. Now, that's not going to work. The kind of leisure is leisure, the kind of leisure that's meaningful is the leisure that I choose to do, and it is open-ended to a certain extent. If I'm watching my clock too closely, it's not exactly leisure. I'm going to be anxious. Grace and peace are key signs of a Mary spirit. How do I know if my spirit is right? Is my life gracious? Do I have inner peace? If I have anxiety and fear, and if I basically find myself worrying and whining, that doesn't sound like Mary. What spiritual leader is not? It's not R&R. It's not laying around with doing nothing. It's not just rest and relaxation. Nor is it R&D. Research and development. It's not preoccupation with the work that didn't get done and the work that should get done. And oftentimes we say quiet time, that's what happens. We make a list. You know, what didn't I do right? What do I need to do? But that's not spiritual leisure. It's not religious activity. It's not church work when the emphasis is on the church and the work. And so oftentimes that's what church work consists of. And it's not petition and prayer. It is not prayer for God to work His work through me or others and make our work more efficient. There's a time for that. That's not what leisure is about. That's not what reflection is about. I find my true self in worship. Feeling alive is what draws us and drives us to work, worship, and just about anything else we do. When you stop and think about it, one of the things that I've learned about myself, I suspect you have or are as well, is there are a very few things that I do that I don't do because they don't make me feel alive. The things that make me feel alive are the things I'm drawn to and the things that drive me. Just think about it for a moment. The things you choose to do, do they give you a sense of being alive? If you're a man, they give you a sense of being a man, a woman, a sense of being a woman, a sense of being a part of a community. There's a connection there I'm going to suggest. Most of the things we choose to do give us a sense of being alive. Now, that's why we do them. Now, there are some things that we avoid because they rob us of life. And that's why we avoid them. One of the reasons many of us find spending time in spiritual leisure with God difficult is because we don't find life there. It's work for us. And I think that is the problem. That's why we need to do this. One of the keys to following Christ is being able to find life experience in Him. And our experience with Him to find life. We're being in His presence spiritually, reflecting on who He is and what He's done, does something to us that energizes our soul and makes us feel alive. For many of us, that's what work does for us. I feel most alive when I've accomplished something. When I've built something, I can look at it and say, it's done. I've done that. I've solved that problem. I feel alive. I feel worth something. That's the kind of experience we should have in our relationship with God. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't feel good when things are accomplished. We should. But so often, our soul is attached to that. And that is the problem. This is Martha's problem. She loves the kitchen, not because she loves hard work. It's because she feels alive in the kitchen. She feels significant in the kitchen. And she understands very well why this is a part of, why hospitality is a part of the culture. And in some respects, the text doesn't say this, but I suspect she's saying Mary's missing out. You know, doesn't Mary understand that you feel better after a hard day's work? You feel better when you've accomplished something. You feel better when you fulfill the expectations of people around you. So get with it, Mary. I mean, the path you're on may be working for temporarily, but sooner or later you're going to feel miserable because you just haven't gotten much done. That's part of the language of our culture. Abide in Christ is our calling. John 15 is a story of where Jesus teaches disciples about bearing fruit. And it's a vine and the branches. Remember that teaching. And basically what Jesus says is this. He says, you abide in me. If you don't abide in me, you won't bear fruit. If you abide in me, you'll bear much fruit. Now, here's the way in which we've concocted that. Following Jesus is about bearing fruit. So we're going to concentrate on bearing fruit. So we basically define fruit. We measure fruit. We have a chart. Chart the fruit. You know, whatever it might be. That's not what he's saying. He's saying, you abide in me, and this will happen. Don't focus on the fruit. Focus on the abiding. When we focus on the abiding, then the doing takes place and the fruit comes. How many of our churches in our culture basically have a mentality of we are going to focus on numbers, or nickels and noses, I call it, like budget and getting people to come to service. We don't care what they do here, just as long as they come. Now that's the first step. We're going to feel good if the church is growing in numbers and growing financially. If our mission support is growing. Whatever we're into, it's growing. I'm going to suggest that I'm not sure that Jesus is nearly as excited about that as we are. Which may disappoint us. I can remember some time ago, several years ago, there was a large church in Denver that wanted me to candidate to be the senior pastor of this multi-campus church. And I went out to visit with them. They had four or five different campuses throughout Denver. And it was a huge church. I happened to have visited that church several years before. Little did I realize that I'd be talking to them about this. And I sat down with the head of the board of elders there, and I said, what are you looking for in a pastor? And I remember the words, we're looking for someone to take us to the next level. Now, I said, well, what do you mean by that? He said, well, we're averaging about 4,000 or 5,000 attendance now, we want to go to 10,000. So it's all about nickels and noses. We've got everything in place here. All we need is a teacher. You know, we've got people managing the programs, so forth. We just need someone who's going to bring them in. I was candid and honest. I said, I'm not the right person for that. You know, you're going in a direction I don't go. I'm not going. But the point is, that culture exists in a lot of churches and in our lives, unfortunately. We're focused on the fruit, on the results, not on abiding. The next level, I would suggest, if you ask me why I responded that way, I'd say, the next level you folks need is to become less busy and more preoccupied, less preoccupied with God's work and more preoccupied with God. He'll take care of the fruit. Don't worry about that. But if you start doing His work, it's not going to be done in a way that glorifies Him. AWOL, absent without leave. Many of us are auditing the Christian life. And it will show up if we have a quiet time, really a real quiet time, and we audit our own hearts. Then we'll realize that. By auditing, I mean we're spectators to it. We show up for the meetings. We are interested. We're committed enough to basically go to class. But we don't have a horse in the race. We're spectators in the stands with no horse in the race. And that characterizes a lot of Christians. We are on the sidelines. Absent without leave. We haven't been permission to be there. We've given ourselves permission to be there. We are not that involved. And the involvement is not just being active and busy in the programs. The involvement is making contact with God. Making contact with God's Spirit in a way in which we are engaged in kingdom stuff, not just in church stuff. Now, when that happens, we're going to show up for work, for God's work, with a different spirit than basically just doing our duty. I have to do this because someone has to. They keep harping at me. Or they're going to talk about me if I don't say yes sooner or later. I've got to do something. I've been here for 14 years and I just haven't been on any committee yet. I mean, that is not the ball game. What God, I'm suggesting, is looking for in our churches, in our Christian fellowships, are people who are seeking Him and are willing then to follow Him. I'm going to suggest Mary is not a person who was not active. But in this situation, Mary models a kind of activity, a kind of spirit in activity that is woefully lacking. Spiritual formation is knowing yourself, accepting yourself, forgetting about yourself, getting over yourself, and giving yourself. And the order there is important. We can't give ourselves until basically we have forgotten about ourselves, until it's not about me anymore. And it can't be about me anymore until I've accepted who I really am and can live with that. And I can't do that until I know who I really am. Now, again, we spend our life doing these things, knowing ourselves, accepting ourselves, forgetting about ourselves, giving ourselves. But there is something of a pattern there. We have been led to believe that personal fulfillment is only possible if we submit to no one but self. No one tells us what to do. We do the choosing ourselves, not realizing that our deepest fulfillment is in submission to something outside of and greater than ourselves. Humans are designed for worship. And we will not be fully and deeply satisfied until we learn how to do that as a way of life. Sabbath is a lifestyle. The Sabbath is a crown of God's creation. In the creation account, it ends with a Sabbath. That's the crowning mark concerning the finish of God's creation. The observance of the Sabbath was a sign of Israel's spiritual special intimacy with God. It was a sign of the covenant. You are my people because we have Sabbath. You keep Sabbath. You meet me on Sabbath. You reflect on me. You have time of leisure away from your work when you basically connect with me anew. You renew your life with me. That makes you special of all people. The inner posture of the soul is what the Sabbath is all about. It's not a special day. Hebrews 4 makes this very clear. It's basically a posture of grace that we have when we work. The Sabbath was made to tutor and protect man. Jesus put it this way. Jesus said to them, "The Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath." We don't observe Sabbath to please God. We observe Sabbath, that is a spirit of rest in our soul, in order to be fully human. The Sabbath is a lifestyle. How do we observe the Sabbath? Rigid legalism is out. It's not a part of the new covenant. One special day, that's an option. If you choose to spend one special day of spiritual leisure, that's great. But insisting that everyone do that is something that's foreign to the new covenant, if you read Romans chapter 14. Grace that finds confidence in the cross of Christ, where I'm not working to please God. I'm working in response to what God has done. And how we work. The real test of the Sabbath spirit is, what do we bring to our work? We bring a spirit of rest. Christian living is the natural outward expression of an inward identity of our heart. Our culture tends to measure a person's worth in terms of doing, that is, expression, more than being, essence. Who we are in God's eyes is basically determined by the character of our heart. The gospel is not about do, it's about done, and our recognition of that. Worship comes after God's work and before ours. The question is not, do we work on the Sabbath, but do we bring the Sabbath to our work? You can be very busy and at the same time have a Sabbath spirit. You can be a Mary in the kitchen. You can be a Martha at Jesus' feet. Now, you probably didn't recognize this, but in the second book in the series that I wrote, Peacemakers, this was chapter 1. So if you don't have the book and want to get a roughly written form of this lesson, it's in that book. If you want a book, I can get you a copy of something. Just let me know. We'll go on to chapter 2 next week, and we'll look at a Mary spirit in a Martha world. How does Mary's spirit work in a Martha world? Romans 12, 1 through 8 is Paul's specific teaching about that, even though he doesn't mention their names.
We're going to have some comments or questions.
Yes.
I see Martha as volunteering so that she can be in charge. She wants to give orders to her sister. She wants to give orders to Jesus. And all doing it as though she's being a servant. And it looks like she wants to really be the master. Do you see that?
Yeah, well, I think that comes... I'm not sure it starts with that. I think it starts with her being drawn away. And that's where everything else gets messed up. When I'm going the wrong direction, I'm going to have a need to control. When I'm following Christ, I lose that need to control. And I think what happens with Martha in the kitchen is she's in the kitchen, things aren't working out, and she's taking charge. Or someone told me once when we had a budget deficit in the church's calendar, and this person came in my office and said, aren't you worried about this? And I said, no, I'm really not worried about this. This is really insignificant. We just make adjustments. Well, you're just like my husband. You know, if somebody doesn't worry about this, what's going to happen? And I said, well, probably some pretty good things, exciting things. You might learn some things. But the point is, many of us feel that if things don't go our way, or the way we expect, then we take charge. Then we basically take a posture that's not that's pretty uncomfortable for people around us. But I'm not sure it started with her being a control freak. I think the control freak came from her misguided preoccupation. You were going to say something earlier.
It was earlier, you were talking about the second slide, and I don't remember where it was, so I really kind of lost the thought. You went through and answered the question that I asked.
Oh, okay. Yes, go ahead.
I don't know if I can say this right, but it's something that came up. God seems to have a tremendous need to be worshipped. And I found that very fascinating, what you were saying, that human beings have been designed to worship. So in a sense, it's kind of a perfect fit.
Yeah.
But this understanding of God needing to be worshipped, how does that...
That's a good observation, good question. Here's the way I understand that. God's greatest desire is to see the nature of God expressed in creation, including mankind. And worship basically becomes a part of the means by which we understand what it means to be fully human. In our worship, we come in touch with our humanity at the deepest level, as image bearers of God. So there's a sense in which the Sabbath becomes for man in the sense that it helps us understand who we are and who God is. Because we understand who God is and we're made in His image. There's something about the union between God's people and God that glorifies God and makes things the way they should be. And that's what it's all about. It's not as though God is an egomaniac and saying, basically, I'm just looking for more slaves out there, kind of thing. Because I got this ego problem, it's kind of slaying ego. I need to work. That's missing the whole point, I think. Yes, there.
Seems like, when we look at the New Testament, it seems like the apostles and disciples, and I look at my life, I include me in that. God is always asking me to get outside my comfort zone.
Yeah.
And somehow that's involved in this rest and stuff too.
Yes, that's right. That's right. I mean, we've created a nest. It's got a lot of burrs and sambers in it, but it's our nest. And leaving that nest is threatening. Yes.
I think it's in our nature to worship something.
Yes.
And we will worship things that the worldly things, or we will worship God. And I think that's where God insists on the priority be appropriate, right? That He is first. Among all things, He is the giver of all things.
Yeah, Joe was saying that we all have a need to worship. I'd put it this way. We all have a hunger for life. And we worship the things that make us feel alive. We give sacrifices to, think about, spend time with, make our decisions in respect to things that make us feel alive. And those become functional messiahs in our life. Things that we worship. And for many of us, it's our work. And for some of us, it could be sex. For some of us, it's our mate. For some of us, our children. Our reputation. Lots of things make us feel alive. And that's what we wind up worshiping. And then we reflect on that and we say, now hold on, why do I do this? Well, I have a hunger to be alive. To experience life. Now where does that come from? And where ultimately is that fulfilled? That we're getting closer and closer to where God is going to say, we're getting it now. We're getting on the same page. But that's a challenge in a life where we have so many distractions. We live in a big kitchen. And we hear a lot of stuff, a lot of expectations. Lots of Marthas around us, coaching us. And basically tempting us to find life in something other than God's nature in us and God. There are lots of things promised that life. Yes?
Along that same line of thought that came when we were talking about our time and the internet.
Yes.
God knew that we were going to create the internet. But He also knew what we were going to do.
technology like the internet that would yield tremendous opportunities for us to network and gather information. But he also understood how we would use it. And it's not always used in a constructive way. It basically is idle searching in many respects.
It's Facebook time.
Yeah.
All right, any more questions?
I think I have a comment. So what I think, Jim, I would suggest is we have Martha and Maggie within us. I mean,
yes.
I hear you.
We do, we do.
You know, there are Marthas around it.
We can all identify with Martha and Mary.
Yeah, and I think it's just, you know, we have both, and probably the culture that we live in, just the human culture, I don't know, the U.S. culture, that promotes us to highlight the Marthas in us, to, you know, nurture the Marthas, and so we become more of Martha than, in fact, we ought to be more like Mary.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think it's not, I mean, I find that it's not more of, you know, who is pushing me to be Martha. It's more of, I got Martha and Maggie and me.
Right.
Which one do I nurture, and which one then becomes more important and dominant in me?
That's a very good point. I mean, there's enough of Martha in us, it doesn't need much encouragement. But just a little push out, it makes it more difficult to say yes to Mary and not to Martha. Yes.
Is this story basically about the priority of worship? Is worship service, not service worship?
Yes. Yes. Yes, exactly.